Welcome everybody to the Defining Time show on Fifth Wrist Radio, and thank you for tuning in. At Fifth Wrist, we are enthusiasts. We're not journalists, we're not brand ambassadors, we are simply community members having a blast, talking about watches, reviewing our own watches on the Fifth Wrist website as well. So thank you to all our listeners and contributors. We are all helping each other learn and learn more and more about the hobby that we absolutely love. So my name's Anthony from Defining Time on Instagram. I'm not joined by a co-host today, but I'm joined by a special guest. So I'm just going to go straight in for it. We'll welcome Dustin from Normal Sinus Rhythm. How are you going?
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me. It's going very well. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And I'm really looking forward to discussing all sorts of topics today. I think it's going to be a really interesting one. And obviously, for people that have seen your Instagram profile, you have some truly, truly amazing and spectacular pieces that, we'll talk a little bit about them and the stories and potentially some interactions with the independent watchmakers that you may have experienced. And we do have a very special story that we will talk about a little bit later on. But before we do all that, start where the important stuff is. So we'll go with you first, Dustin. So what is on your wrist and what are you drinking today?
Sure. So let's see, where I am in Ohio in the United States, it is around 9 o'clock. So I'm definitely armed with a drink and obviously a watch. So on my wrist, I have an Armin Strom Gravity Equal Force, which is a new release from Armin Strom and relatively new acquisition for me within the year. Mine's a little interesting because it was a limited edition from Oster Jewelers in Colorado, and it's a 1 of 10 piece. And the cool thing about it is it has a custom Kari Voutilainen hand guilloche base plate. So, as well as the colorways that they chose.
I didn't notice that. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it's hard to see, but that is not a normal thing. And obviously, anytime you can put a little Kari into your watch, it's not a bad thing. But I don't want to sell Armin Strom short either. I've been incredibly impressed with them, and they have been accommodating almost to a fault. They're wonderful to work with.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. So I actually think it's wonderful that Kari Voutilainen is showing up in all sorts of areas over the last 12 months. And I think that that when you talk about someone leaving a legacy for many years to come, yes, his watches are, out of this world, and, but they're also prices are out of this world as well. When you can start to get into some Kari artistry and from his dial factory in, not too many thousands of US dollars, you can pick up something that's quite special and that will certainly outlive him and be part of his legacy. So I'm really, really happy to see this kind of exposure that he's getting. What are your thoughts on it all?
Well, I mean, I think it's great. And honestly, I think it illustrates how kind of the juxtaposition between some of the big brands, which are oftentimes reluctant to work together or at odds with each other, and the collaborative nature of the independent watchmakers. They're happy to help each other. They're all friends, and it's really a situation of strength in numbers, and we're all better together. So I support that wholeheartedly.
Absolutely. I think I've been looking at Armstrong for a number of years, but I could never get over the chin on some of their pieces that they do. It bothered me that there was this little lip at 6 o'clock. But I've noticed that there's a number of watches that they're bringing out now that don't have it. And they've had some watches that don't do it. But I started looking in a little bit more once I'd spoken to Marco from Swiss Watch Gang. So shout out to him. He's done a fair bit of work with them. And I just think they're doing some really, really impressive stuff, which they always have done.
Yeah, he did. He actually did a nice video of this watch. And this watch, to be sure, it still has that lip. It's just much more reduced. But it's a, that's kind of their trademark. But this watch is cool because it really gives you an ingenious way of preserving chronometry over the power reserve of the watch. It's one of the first watches that has fit a Maltese cross declutching mechanism into an automatic movement. So basically, this it winds with a motor barrel, and the motor barrel will has a Maltese cross declutching mechanism that will basically stop the watch at the if there's too little wind and if there's too much wind. So the 72-hour power reserve is supposedly with equal force.
Wow.
And I will say, I think it works. This watch runs like a top.
So for those playing along at home, if you jump onto Dustin's Instagram, normal.sinus.rhythm, you'll see this watch if you just scroll down a little bit. But Dustin, is that the Maltese cross wheel that you're talking about? Is can you see that just above that lip at 6 o'clock in the barrel? Is that what is there?
Yes, it is. You can see it, and then there's actually a
Ah.
little power reserve in the middle. So that's the motor barrel, kind of around 5 o'clock on the watch face, on the bottom of the three bridges.
Oh, I see. Wow. Wow, that's really cool. And it's fascinating stuff when you really start to get into some of the things that these brands are doing now, which is awesome. So anyway, we might touch on this watch again a little bit later, but we'll get into my drink check. I've actually got three drinks today. I'm triple dueling, I think Fifth Wrist is now calling it. So I have a water, I have a coffee, and I also have a beautiful 15-year-old Glenfiddich. It's hot in Australia right now, so I have put some ice in there, but please don't shoot me.
No, I like ice. I think ice is can be good.
Well, I do too, because and one of the things that I learned a while ago about whiskey, while I was in Scotland, actually, I went to a distillery just outside of Edinburgh called Glenkinchie. And one of the things that they talked about was that whiskey was best drunk at 33% alcohol. So most whiskeys come in around the 43. So you need circa a quarter to just over a quarter, maybe 2/5 of water to balance out, and that's when you get the most fragrant amount. So I find that just two drops of ice and let it start to dissolve and melt, and you get this really beautiful floral taste out of the whiskey. So I'm no expert, but do you know much about that?
Well, I mean, I'm in bourbon country here. We're really close to, but I'll tell you the kind of a lot of people who are into bourbon really like the super barrel strength, cask strength bottlings, which will, you know, which are effectively flammable. A lot of them are really still quite smooth and delicious, but I always might prefer mine with a little lower proof and potentially a little you know, a little water, a little ice. The
Yeah.
one thing they say with high proof whiskey though is you can always add water, but you can't take water away. So
Yeah.
if the whiskey feels a little too watered down, then nothing you can do about that. So I
No.
forgot to do my drink check, by the way, which I feel like I've
Yeah,
already
what have
broken
you
the
got?
rules, and we're,
That's all
you
right.
know, a few
Yeah.
minutes into this. And it's not a whiskey, actually. I am drinking an añejo tequila, Don Julio 1942. And it is super smooth. My friend recommended it, knowing I liked whiskey. And he said it's kind of like if a single malt scotch or a nice bourbon and tequila had a baby. And I think that's a pretty good description. It's quite good.
Well, I don't think in 130 odd episodes we've had a tequila yet. I could be wrong, but and if I am wrong, someone let me know. But I think this is the first tequila. And so you're drinking tequila with a couple of blocks of ice.
Just a single ice cube,
Wow.
and normally I drink this neat, but I just wanted a cold drink, I guess. And
Yeah.
I will tell you, I searched high and low for Wakachangi, and in places where if it's available, it would have been there. So it must not be available where I live. So,
Wow, it looks like
but I did try.
Fifth Wrist has single-handedly sold out Wakachangi worldwide. I have no evidence to back that up, but I still haven't tried it yet, to be honest.
Yeah, well.
I'm still drinking my low carb beer, so when that runs out, I'll have to go get a six
You'll
pack
have to
just to
do
see
one.
if I
I don't
like
know
it.
if it, yeah, you're not a real
Who
man until you
knows?
have it, right? I think
Well,
that's what they say.
exactly. According to these guys.
That's right.
All right. Now I'll do my wrist check quickly, and my wrist check today is a watch that we both share, which is fantastic, and that is my H. Moser and C. Pioneer Centiseconds with the midnight blue Fume dial. So I've been wearing it on this orange OEM strap recently, and I took it off yesterday to put the leather strap on, but it was just, it's too hot here in Australia at the moment. So it's back on the black rubber. And I'm really proud of this watch. It was a very long time coming and it's just such a cool piece. When did you get yours?
I got mine about a year and a half ago, maybe a little bit longer. The interesting thing, so I was at a medical conference. I'm an anesthesiologist. I do cardiac anesthesia. I'm an anesthesiologist by day and watch nut by night. But I was at a conference and had some free time in Chicago. And there's quite a few stores that sell independent watches. And I went to a store there and I looked at F.P. Journe. I looked at Erwerk, Debatun, a couple of different brands. So pretty much everything's on offer. And for some reason, I was really drawn to the simplicity of the Mosers. And of the Mosers, I just really liked the idea of that sport watch case. I thought the case flanks of the Pioneer were beautiful. It was, despite the little bit larger size, it was very comfortable. And the rest is history. I couldn't live without it. So I needed it.
And you experienced the Pioneer Tour, did you or didn't you?
No, I did. Absolutely. I was one of the lucky recipients of that and, you know, got to compare them side by side. I prefer the steel because you can put the bracelet with it and completely change the look of the watch. And they sell the bracelet separately, which is awesome. But both were cool. And that was a fun experience. The fact that I was wondering if it was going to arrive like beat to shit, and it wasn't. It was really immaculate, and it's a testament to how much respect I think watch collectors have for their watches, and even maybe more so the watches of other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was actually telling Mike Margolis this morning that I hadn't experienced it yet, and it hadn't come to Australia. He went on to talk about how, I don't know, patriotic Americans were, or that they wanted to keep everything here, which was funny. But Mike, if you're listening, please send it to Australia. We'd love to have it and send it around here. But yeah, that's my wrist check. I've had it for about 2.5 months now, and it's only been in the last week to 2 weeks that I've started going back to some other pieces because, yeah, I could not take it off.
You got to have that honeymoon period or it doesn't count.
You do. You do. It's funny when you experience it. I know Klaus was talking about his beautiful day-night Oxen Junior that he's had, and he's had it for about 2 months as well, and he's not been able to take it off. And I think he's a bit blinded by the honeymoon period. But it does. It is that honeymoon period is a real thing where you look at everything else and you just go, "Nah, I'm wearing this one again," which is fun, I think. And it's nice to transition back to some of your other pieces after you get over that honeymoon period. But it does take a while.
Yeah, I haven't had a watch yet where I've done the honeymoon period and it's completely squashed my desire to reach for another watch eventually. I don't know what I'd do if that happened. I guess that means so I'm done. I've reached nirvana.
Absolutely. I don't know it could ever happen because we as society we get bored so quickly and we always want new things. But yeah, maybe there is a watch one day.
Well, you got to have that next. We're always in search of that next dopamine hit.
Absolutely. We love it. All right. So I'm going to do some rapid fire questions and then we'll get into the conversation in getting to know you a little bit better, in particular your watch journey. Sure. But then talk about some of your collection and as I said before, potentially some of the experiences that you've had with some wonderful independent watchmakers. So are you ready? 5 questions.
Go.
Rolex or Omega?
Omega.
Vintage or modern?
Modern.
Mainstream or indie?
Indie.
A few watches or a lot of watches?
A lot of watches.
Flip or keep?
That's a tough question, but I would say keep.
Ah, bravo. Well done. Well done. God, you threw me off when you said Omega. I was like, what?
Well, I know. I could tell. You
explain yourself. I was stumped.
Your speed went much slower.
It did.
So I have a couple reasons for that. The first thing is kind of what started my watch journey in the first place was a gift from my parents. So when I graduated medical school, my parents, who had no business buying me a watch, knew that I loved watches and knew that I loved the Bond Seamaster and ended up buying me the Omega Seamaster Professional Chronograph, the blue one. So that was really my first really nice kind of luxury watch. So I have a sentimental connection to Omega from that. I have since purchased a Omega Aquaterra when I graduated from residency, and then a Speedmaster Professional when I finished my board certification and fellowship. So I guess furthermore, I also bought both of my boys. I have a 3-year-old and a almost 1-year-old, and bought Omegas that they will inherit at some point, in their early adulthood, that I wore for each of them. And I wore those watches on the day of their birth and have all the
Wow.
pictures with them and everything. So Omega kind of holds a special place in my heart.
Yeah.
Nothing against Rolex. I like Rolex, but Omega is my first love of the juggernauts.
Very cool. Well, and I suppose that's the thing. That's what some of these connections is all about. But I think to it sounds like when there's a big sort of event like your son's born or graduations and things like that, that Omega's been the one to go to, which
It
is cool.
has. I mean, other things, that might not continue forever, but at least for those things it has. And the other thing that I didn't mention with Rolex, which is I think a kind of a interesting issue, is I'm a physician, and Rolex, for as good as their watches are and as regarded as they are, they do hold somewhat of a negative connotation in certain situations, and I'm sometimes sensitive of that. One reason I like independent watches is because I buy them for me, and nobody knows what they are, so I can wear them with reckless abandon, and nobody really recognizes it. They can look at it and tell objectively, well, that's a very nice watch, but it's a
Yeah,
little
they don't know
different.
how much it. Yeah, it's such a true thing. I remember, I had a BLNR and I bought mine back in 2016. And I used to have people, I could just see them, I'd be at a meeting or something. I was in banking and finance and people were just staring at it. And because the ceramic bezel is quite catches light in all sorts of different ways, and I could just see that these people that were a lot more superior to me were wearing, these big 41, 44 mil tag chronographs that were their special watch that they bought when they'd made it. And it made me feel awkward. And so I ended up buying, I actually bought an Explorer because it was just so small and so tiny. No one even blinked an eye at it. And it really did work. No one even noticed that watch. But I look now and I think to myself, I love looking at my collection and going, which, where am I going today, and what are the potential? Is there any sort of negative connotation to what I'm doing, whether it's a family get together or something like that? And I stick on the Moser or the Oxen Junior or the Habering, and people just have no idea. And that's what I really do enjoy that because, like you said, it's for me. It's not for anyone else. But Rolex does come with that.
Absolutely, and it's really interesting. I mean, I've been in an AD before that is, pretty big store with many watch brands, and I think I was wearing my Groenfeld Principia, and the salesperson came up to me and looked and whatever and said, "Oh, that's a nice watch," and then she said, "Are you think do you think you're ready to step up to a date just?" And I was like, "Well, I was like, maybe. Do you have any? I'm not gonna make a big scene of it or anything, but it was a perfect example. Like I smiled on the inside a little when she said that, so.
I had the same experience with my Habering, where someone asked me if I was ready to get an automatic watch, because it was a deadbeat seconds and I thought it
Deadbeat
was a
seconds,
quartz.
that's right.
But it's and you know that to me also, that's part of the inside baseball fun of independence is, the majority, 99.9% of people have zero idea. And I think that's what that is part of the attraction, is that it is for you and for you only, and for the select few that know and understand that part of the watch industry.
Absolutely. And if anybody ever somebody recognizes your Moser or recognizes me wearing a De Batoon, I know that that person, I have a better than 50-50 chance of becoming friends with that person.
Correct. Exactly right.
That's right.
And the conversation is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it might be good. A little, talk some watches for a little while.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's do that and continue doing that. So, I mean, you've given us really great insight into your journey, but is there anything more about how you got into watches yourself, and it sort of when did it happen for you?
So, I mean, I've always liked watches. I've had them. I've worn them like through high school, not expensive ones. In college, I had a Tissot, which I absolutely loved. It was a PRS 200 quartz chronograph. It was, a little flashy, but still, I had that and always kind of liked watches as a style accessory and appreciated it for the, mechanical nature of them as well. So I've always kind of liked them. It wasn't really until that Omega Seamaster that something kind of clicked, and it was like the weight of it and just the feel of it and like the precision of how the clasp went together. All of those things just sort of clicked, and I kind of went crazy. So many, many, many watches later, I'm a certified addict. I would say that, I kind of started in the very similar to how other people probably start, dabbled a little bit in vintage because I could find some affordable things, and moved into some Grand Seiko, some regular Seiko, Omega. And it wasn't really until recently that this independent bug kind of bit me.
But once it does, it is a ruthless rabbit hole to go down.
It's it's supremely unfortunate because the expenses can be high. Doesn't have to be though. That's what I always tell people. No. It's like you would be surprised at you can find in the independent watch world for very, very reasonable money. I would say the one thing about the independents which has just floored me is the interaction. Being a part of the process, being close to the people, and really feeling like you're supporting the artisans, which I don't feel like when I'm buying an Omega or a Grand Seiko. Like I know I am kind of exponentially down the line, but not in the same way, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a very different way. And I mean, I look at your last post, and it's that beautiful. Is that the Topper Julia Oris, the Diver 65? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. And Rob Kaplan, who is one of the co-owners with his brother of Topper Jewelers. That's it's a family jewelry company. I've been shopping there for many, many, many years. I've never met him in person. However, we talk, probably every couple of days. And I just think they do a wonderful job with limited editions and just the way they bring things together in a cohesive way. The proof of concept is just incredible.
Yeah. Before we go into more about watches, have you ever collected anything else besides watches?
Oh, yeah. I've always kind of been a collector. I collected baseball cards when I was younger, addicted to those sufficiently as well. I remember if I got in trouble or something and I wasn't allowed to go to the baseball card shop, I would time it so that I could ride my bike there in the amount of time it took between getting off the bus and my mom getting home. So the addiction gene is certainly alive and well in me.
Yeah.
I currently collect bourbon and whiskey to some extent and mid-century modern furniture.
Nice. I have, it's not as big as it used to be, but I collected hats as a kid, and I've got some amazing hats from, like, the probably one of the best ones I've got is a 1986 Adelaide Grand Prix Formula One hat. That's like it's all dusted and it's nearly falling apart, but it's still in its plastic. It's never been opened, and 300 odd hats later, it's
like baseball caps or like other types of hats.
Basically, baseball caps. Just that's every time awesome. I went anywhere, I just got a hat, and I loved hats, and now I've sort of move to some other types of hats. Like I love Stetson Open Roads. They're just amazing, amazing hats, and they're reasonably priced for what they are and how long they last. But yeah, I've got a few Baker Boys and all sorts of stuff. So I did. And when I travel, I generally buy a hat from wherever I go because it's just another, and they don't have to be expensive. They could be $20 or $30, something like that. And it's just a piece of a memento of that trip or whatever that was for. So that's but I'm going down a rabbit hole in fountain pens at the moment. I can tell you one thing, it's cheaper than watches, which is great.
But still quite dangerous if you get anything else. If you the deeper down the rabbit hole you go, eventually the bank account suffers. So
yeah.
But watches at this point I had to pretty much, choose watches.
Well, I've learned something recently, which is, and I'm hoping that I'm taking some learnings from my watch sort of enthusiasm to fountain pens, where I'm buying a brand that you're able to change the nibs. So I'm eventually, in the next couple of weeks, I'll have two of these fountain pens that are both piston fillers, but I will have 7 nibs that I'll be able to change anywhere from fine all the way up to a 1.5 mil stub. So for any fountain pen people out there, it's just crazy that you're able to do that, with a lot of companies don't really allow for that. Or, you know, Mont Blanc wanted to charge me $500 to get a different size nib on one of my fountain pens. I'm just like, no, I'm not doing that. It's ridiculous.
I think that's the equivalent to like a strap monster in the watch game.
Yeah.
You can just buy it like a Panerai or something. I have a fountain pen recommendation for you.
Sweet. What is it?
So I above all else, I like convenience, and mm-hmm. fountain pens to me are one of the least convenient objects in the world. But the Pilot or Namiki, the Vanishing Point, is a clickable, retractable fountain pen that is beautifully made. You can do cartridges or piston filler, and it's stored nib up as a retractable pen, and they are not that expensive. So if you don't have one, grab one.
I will most likely end up with one, I'm sure. To be honest, it's interesting. I'll stop talking about this in a sec, but I'm actually trying to do the opposite of what I normally do. And in my last probably 18 months to 2 years, I've started buying only few things, but getting absolute premium quality craftsmanship when I'm doing it. So recently commandeered a custom-made pocket knife, which I feel like now I've got exactly what I wanted. I don't need anything else, and I'll keep that for the rest of my life. I've done it with a few jackets and things like that. So what I'm trying to do with this fountain pen, the pens I've bought, they're not cheap. They're not crazy expensive, but the fact that I can swap in and out, it's going to give me all these different experiences for really the same price. So I'm trying to not go down the rabbit hole of getting everything on the way up, and just trying to go to the top end and experience what the best is like, so that I can, you know, experience that for the rest of my life. But anyway, that'll probably change a bit, but who knows?
I think that's a good philosophy to live by when you're buying things. You buy the best you can afford, quality over quantity. And I know I'm contradicting my answer of few watches or many watches in the quick, you know, in the rapid fire questions, but who wouldn't pick many watches if it was an option? It's always if it's an option, you got to have many.
Absolutely. So we'll get back to your collection. So you have it's a stunning collection. I know it's something that I'm sure you're extremely proud of, and I love being able to look through it through Instagram, which is amazing. But I did want to ask, how have your tastes changed over time? But in particularly, what sort of non-negotiables did you used to have that may have changed now, or things that you thought you'd never buy that you now buy, or that you couldn't live without that now you just don't care about? So what are some of those aspects of the changing over time, and then what are the non-negotiables that have changed, if any?
Sure. So I think that above all else, I wear my watches. So the only real non-negotiable is, can I envision myself strapping this on and wearing it? So I'm not buying them for them to sit in the back of the safe. That's just not my personality. I want to wear it. I want to wear it immediately upon getting it. And so that's really the only non-negotiable. I also buy what I like. I buy from my heart. Certainly, if things hold value, that's great. But it's certainly not the thing that dictates it's not primary in my considerations when I'm purchasing a watch. I've moved, I would say, into more simplistic watches. Time-only watches is a kind of a micro theme within my collection, but time-only watches done exquisitely well. So an example of that would be the Bulgari Octofinissimo, obviously ultra-thin, incredible design, and time-only. The Gravity Equal Force, same thing, by Armin Strom, time-only. Your Moser, time-only. Everything, in the end of the day, complications they're neat from a mechanical standpoint, but they're not necessary because you have a smartphone, which is basically a computer in your pocket. So,
yeah.
So that's really, I would say, one thing that I'm kind of leaning toward now. Certainly, finishing is really, really important to me. It might not have been initially, but but the quality of finishing, the quality of handwork, the fact that there is handwork in general that goes into something, those things I certainly really like. And I think one of the themes that I'm going with now is some type of connection to either the person making it or to the person selling it to me. So I want to support people in the end of the day with my watch purchases. I want to get a good watch out of it too, but I really am after an experience where I can support people that I care about, support brands that I care about, and really be a custodian for their artwork.
And that, I think that's, and I've talked about it a lot on the podcast around my experiences with Richard Habering and Ed Maylan, and, you know, just even with Mark, who's recently resigned from Oxen Jr. But still, like, just the experience that you get with them is you can't explain it until you actually go through it. And I think that you just can't get that. I know there's some wonderful people that work in ADs, and there's some wonderful relationships that people have, but it's not the same. It's not the same as the person that's able to create the watch. What's probably your favorite interaction or experience that you've had with an independent watchmaker from your collection?
So I bought a couple of mine pre-owned. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to like be a part of that process, but I can give you a few of them. I will say when I bought my Moser, I got a personalized message from Ed Maylan, you know, the CEO of the company. That's, what are the odds of that happening? Like, well, very good when you buy a Moser. I can tell you that much. He's very good about that, and that company is very good about that. But in general, that's not something that happens.
Can I just say, just while we're on here, because I think there's something really important here, that Ed Maylan is absolutely the face of Moser and the one that makes everyone feel extremely special about becoming part of the Moser family. However, some of my experiences lately with the other people that work for Moser have been just as good as Ed. So I think that there's another level inside Moser that is, and they're scattered all over the world as well. They're part of distribution or whatever it might be. And they're just amazing people that only want you to be happy with your purchases. And they do some seriously cool stuff. So yeah, I just wanted to say that again. I know I said it recently, but shout out to the whole crew at Moser, because while Ed is the face, there is a team of people that are just as passionate and just as sort of crazy about their customers as he is.
You mentioned Mike Margolis. He's been a wonderful brand representative, for us in the United States, and has treated me very, very well as well. Couple other experiences that I've had, even though I ended up buying my Groenfeld, and immediately was kind of interacting with Bart and Tim over social media, of course. And then something that's happening currently is I am having a Habering made as well. And I won't reveal too many details, but I will say I kind of gave my ideas, and I said, do you think this might be possible? And I dealt directly with Maria over the course of a few months to kind of plan things. And I remember one specific email where I asked if something's possible, knowing full well that a lot of the times, and especially the Swiss watch industry, the phrase, it is not possible, is heard all too often. And her phrase was, anything is possible. And the attentiveness and responsiveness and involving me has been fantastic. I'm really excited for that watch. I can't wait for it. So
yeah, no, they are just, I think we actually got a podcast coming up soon. Not with them. Unfortunately, they are extremely busy. But with me going into bat for Habering as a bit of a battle, where we're going to get a couple of different people to represent a brand, so to speak, and then go up against each other. It's just going to be a bit of fun. I'm sure there's going to be some wonderful sort of competition out there as to why someone loves this particular brand. But, you know, once you experience Habering, it really is the most amazing part of this industry, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Richard and Maria Hebring might be, you know, nice people in the world, number one and two. You know, it's just, they're just so great. I have one last story, actually. The funny thing is, yeah, I could probably go on the entire podcast about personal interactions with independent watchmakers, because that's really what it's all about. But when I bought my Arm & Strom I bought it from Oster Jewelers in Colorado. And you know, I was working with Jeremy. I actually asked him if, you know, I was like, did they ever think about doing the hands in heat blued steel as opposed to, you know, rhodium plating? And he was like, that's a very good question. Let me ask Claude being Claude Griesler, one of the owners of Arm & Strom and the head watchmaker. So Jeremy got back to me and said Claude had proceeded to field the question. They heat blued some hands, installed them on a watch, took pictures, decided it looked awesome, and said that they even preferred it and that they'd be happy to offer it to me at no charge. And I was like, I feel like I'm on Neptune. The fact that this is happening is so cool. So
yeah, no, it's unbelievable. I think the way that this sort of stuff can be experienced. And yeah, I've got a few more stories I haven't told yet, but I'll keep them for another time.
And to think I've been begging my local AD for a 5711 for years, and they just look at me like I'm trash. So
yeah, well, that's another story. But while we're on ADs, what I do want to talk about a little bit is Rolex, and in particularly you recently purchased a red dial OP, one of the new ones. So yes, I think I'll ask my question about Rolex having its place in collections with multiple independents, because I do want to discuss that a little bit. But before we do that, can you tell us the story with you and your father about the OPs that you recently got a couple of months ago?
Absolutely. So so when these first got released, when these OPs first got released, I was pretty smitten with them. I like things that are off the beaten path, and the throwback to the Stella dials, time only, the size that I liked, everything just looked great. And I was like, man, I haven't thought about buying a Rolex in a year or so, or you know, maybe a little bit longer. But this one really caught my eye. So I told my AD that I was interested in the red, and was anybody else interested in the red? And fortunately, no one was. So they kind of, you know, earmarked me for it just in case. In the preceding time from when that happened to when or from, you know, putting my name down to getting the watch, we had kind of a family tragedy that happened, and my mother passed away. She died very suddenly, and it wasn't something that was planned, but was obviously very, very traumatic. You know, I'm happy to share, she had an anaphylactic reaction, and with no real history of bad allergies. Wow. So, you know, being an anesthesiologist, if that happens to you in the hospital, it's a dangerous and potentially lethal thing. If it happens to you at home, it just exponentially, yeah, it makes it exponentially worse. So that happened back in September, not too long ago. So, you know, when this happened, I was trying to think of, you know, what can I, you know, I almost didn't feel like buying any watches or doing anything, because you're just, you know, you're very, very sad and just and grieving. But then I thought, you know, my mom was a very happy person, a very upbeat person, kind of marched to the beat of her own drummers, not somebody who would ever buy the plain dial watch. She would always buy the colored dial watch. And I thought, well, hell, maybe this is telling me something. I want to buy this this OP that I was planning on buying to commemorate her life. And so that was what I said, and I told my AD that, and they immediately were, you know, very touched and thought it was a great idea. And I said, I want to engrave it immediately with her initials on the back. And the cool part about this is I convinced my father to also do this. I'm an only child, so it's just me and my dad. And I convinced him to do it as well. So he, you know, being in his 70s, he didn't want a bright color. He wanted a black one. So he was like, if I'm going to do this, I just want the black one. So we talked to him, we talked to my AD about that as well. And the most crazy part of the story is that we had both decided to do it. And to this day, my AD has received two Oyster Perpetuals in all colors and all sizes. And they received one 41 millimeter in coral red and one 41 millimeter in black, wow. My watch and my dad's watch. So it really felt like divine intervention. And my dad hasn't taken it off since. And it's a really special thing that we have now.
Wow. I can't thank you enough for sharing that story. Obviously, it's December at the moment, so September really is not that far behind us. And, you know, I think as we're talking a little bit before, and I do believe in, you know, some sort of universal power that allows things to happen for certain reasons. And, you know, you don't have to look too far to know how difficult things can be to get and stuff like that. And, you know, the fact that you've done this to commemorate your mum is just an amazing story. And I'm so pleased for you and your dad to be able to do this and share this together, because I know that for many years to come, it's going to be extremely special. And you'll be able to wear that watch on special days, etc. So thank you very much for sharing that story.
Well, you know, my mom was one of the people who didn't just glaze over when I talked about watches, because she could see how passionate I was about it. So it's the least I could do to honor her life from the watch standpoint. And I will say that you know, it hasn't been very long, but just watches and the watch community in general, I'm in a collector community called Collective. Which is based out of kind of the California, but really has extended all over the United States and with some international members as well. And the outpouring and outreach from people in there, from my hometown, from ADs I've worked with and stuff, has been nothing short of amazing. So yeah. It's really, some of my really closest friends are connected with the watch industry. I've told someone else I'm stuck now. Like I pretty much have to like watches the rest of my life because all my friends are in this. So like, I can't get rid of these people. So
no, it's so true. And I think that's the wonderful power of social media, where, you know, we are so many people in this wonderful hobby are so far away from each other, yet so connected, and can have such a positive impact on each other through difficult times, through happy times, whatever it is. You know, this community is so strong and so bound all around the world, which truly is fantastic.
Right. The last thing I didn't say about the OPs, sure. which I think is important, is I was going to do this regardless if my dad said yes or no. Eventually he said yes. And I'm glad we could share that for me and him, but I was secretly also glad that now I have two, because I have two sons and I want them to inherit these watches someday.
Yeah.
So they can, whichever one's a crazy guy can have the red one, I guess, but they'll have to fight over which one they want. So,
oh, well, I'm sure they'll be grateful for either. But no, that's a beautiful story. So thank you again. I do want to stay on Rolex, because I think one of the interesting things about Rolex is, while, you know, I talk for myself and I see from other people that Rolex seems to be something that still does hang around when people move into independence. And it's not because people don't sell anything or anything like that. There is still this humongous attraction to something about Rolex. And I did just want to sort of discuss a little bit with you and share some of my thoughts as well around why we think this is the case. So is there anything particular about Rolex that, because, you know, if you look at your collection, you go from Erwerk to Debethune to Moser, and then there's OP. And they're obviously completely different watches and bought for completely different reasons. But that, I think that's not part of what we're trying to do here. But why do you think there is such a stronghold when people do move on to independence for them to still love Rolex?
Sure. Well, first off, I would say that I think a Seiko 5 and an Erwerk can absolutely coexist in the same in the same collection, because as long as when you strap it on, it makes you happy and puts a smile on your face, I'm down. That's really criteria number one for me. But specifically with Rolex, I think there's a couple of different things. I think first off, it's just such an, it's one of the most powerful brands, not just watch brands, but brands in general in the entire world. And it's such an aspirational purchase. It is synonymous with success the world over. People recognize it. They celebrate moments with it. Rolex in their marketing tends to associate themselves with people who have had, who have seen and enjoyed great success in their lives. So I think there is an aspirational component of it. And then I think there's a practical component, and that is two practical components. One, they are built very well. I mean, they're machine made, but they are built extremely well. They'll last a very long time, and they're going to be a reliable, nice watch. So that's very practical. And then two, they tend to hold their value, and a lot of people don't like losing money. I think that practical portion has actually flipped us a little bit into some negative things as well within the watch industry with respect to flipping and people buying speculatively. So so there's some issues that I personally take with that, but I don't fault people for you know, wanting their purchases to preserve value.
Yeah, I think that that is a huge part of it. And the only other things that I would probably add to those, and I agree with all of that, is I think that Rolex, to me anyway, has been, well, part of it is to respect the journey of getting to the independence. And in, you know, yes, generally speaking, for a lot of people, either Seiko or Tag Heuer can be the gateway in. But then there's that next step, which might be Omega, or it might be Rolex. And so then by the time you buy the Rolex, if you're an enthusiast, some people, maybe they come into success, they go buy a Rolex, and that's the only one they'll ever get, because that, you know, they're not watch guys, but they know Rolex, as you said, one of the most powerful brands in the world. But then there's others that have had to go on a journey to get to Rolex, and that was very much myself. So the quality of a Rolex and the accuracy and the looks, like they do look, they are fantastic looking watches. So I think for me, moving into independence now, would I ever buy another Rolex? Probably not, although I do really like the Tiffany Blue OP. But I just
do it.
I don't know. I'm maybe I
you
will
get the opportunity, do it. Sure. It's a wonderful watch. And I will say, despite the fact that some of my independents are, you know, obviously is higher horology, whatever, however terms you want to say, there is something about a Rolex bracelet and the and just the way it's machined and the way it clicks when it clasps, that is, it's just, it's engineering perfection. You know, they do a wonderful job. So I would never fault Rolex for their watches. They make great ones.
Yeah, and I think if you look in the other part for me as well, is many wonderful independents own Rolexes. So, and the one that comes to mind, luckily for me, I share one with Roger Smith. So the 11427036 mil Explorer, that's his daily watch. And I'm thinking, okay, so for this guy, I believe his wife bought it for him for a birthday or something like that. And he wears it every day when he's making these beautiful one of tens or one off hand built from scratch, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar watches, and he can wear this, you know, 36mm Explorer. So there's that part to it. But I think as well, it's a lot of the time when you're really starting to get into the hobby, it's kind of like the first love as well. When you get that the first time, the experience and the feeling that you have putting on that watch and knowing that it's yours, and yes, take out the flippers from this, there's a feeling with that that you never forget. So it is interesting though.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is, I've resisted Rolex. Like, I think I've actively resisted in a weird way, which is not good. Like the siren calls that I resisted. But I will say I've owned three in my life. I still own them. I have them. I have a Berthier GMT. I have a ceramic Daytona, black on black. And then a that was the first new one I ever purchased was a ceramic Daytona. So that's it. It's the you know for the dreamers, it can happen. And then the OP, you know. So you know, and they fit. They still fit beautifully in the collection. So it's a wonderful it's a wonderful addition, regardless of kind of where your collection's going.
It's so true, and it's part of the experience, I think. And unfortunately, I think for a lot of people, especially people only getting into the hobby in the last sort of 12, 18 months, maybe 2 years, where the unobtainable aspect of Rolex, and then the hate starts because the frustration's there that they can't get it or they don't want to pay double retail, so they go off. And I see so many comments on social media forums and things like that where people say, you know, so much better out there than Rolex. And in a lot of cases, that's true. But you miss that experience if you never get to go down that path. And that's why I do feel for some people these days that develop the frustration and the hate so early on, because potentially they're going to wait 10, 20 years to before they go back and try and experience that.
My fear, because I, you know, in the end, I want everybody, I just want people to like watches and wear watches and be supportive of the industry. And if you have someone who's been dreaming of a black Submariner for forever, and all of a sudden it is impossible for them to get, maybe they don't even, maybe they go, maybe they put out, strap on a smartwatch and get
Buy
into a
a
different
fountain
hobby. And absolutely exactly right, or get into cars, or just or whatever they're gonna get into. So, I really think it's doing a disservice to the community. And I know personally, I've seen friends who've been really put off by the shortages and the speculation and the flipping and all of kind of like the rigmarole around this ridiculous situation. One of my friends talked to me the other day and was looking at buying a pre-owned Rolex that would historically not be very desirable for a quote unquote quick catch and release. And I just told him, I was like, don't do that, man. I was like, just buy what you like. And you know, worst case, you know, this could end. All this weirdness could end. And then you're stuck with this watch that you don't even really like. You know, don't buy watches that you don't like because you think that you're going to make 500 or 1,000, or, you know, sometimes we're talking really a lot of money, things that go for 2x retail or whatever. But I'm just not about that. That's not my style. So.
And there's a lot of scammers out there as well now, which is getting bigger and bigger every day. I'm seeing these stories of someone being ripped off or this watch's been stolen or whatever. And it's like, you know, if you bought a Daytona to then flip it and then got scammed, that's going to hurt. So,
Well, I mean, you know, the Australian watch community is no stranger to that situation.
no,
So.
certainly not. But anyway, all right. So look, I think that was interesting. And for people playing along at home, if you've got an opinion and if you're in our Slack group, put a post up, be happy to talk about it. And maybe if you're someone that was frustrated by it and has moved on to other brands or has given up or something like that, you know, reach out, let us know. I'd love to know what people think, because it is an interesting topic that I can't see it going away anytime over the next at least 5 years. But who knows? Who knows? All right, back to your collection. I want to
Sure.
know an interesting question, and you can answer it however you will, but what is your favorite watch in your collection or the most prized possession? Now, can we take the OP out?
You can take, actually, there's a couple of sentimental pieces that I'm going to remove because,
Okay, good.
you know, the actually, even the OP, the one, the singular watch that if I had to keep one, get rid of everything else, and just ride off into the sunset, it would be that first Omega that my parents both gave me when I the first one that I started. That would be it, because it's not my favorite watch from like a design perspective or one that I wear the most now, but it's the one that means the most to me from a sentimental standpoint. So I have a couple of sentimental pieces, and I really don't even kind of include them in my collection because they're not touchable. All the ones from my medical milestones, all that stuff, they might as well not even exist because they're part of me. They're permanent entities, I would say.
Yeah. Makes sense.
But my favorite current watch is probably a, just in sheer usability and stuff, it's actually Vacheron Constantin Overseas with a blue dial.
Yeah.
I've been a huge fan of the integrated bracelet look for forever. I know it's super hot right now, but like I've always liked it. That watch specifically is super underrated. Although I think it's getting a lot more notoriety now than even a year ago, but the quick chain strap system makes it so versatile. It's finished impeccably. It's kind of nice to not kind of like that. It's not a, you know, one of the quote unquote hype watches, probably that one. It's
how does it
wear.
Compare? How does it compare to your AP?
So I just got the AP. I ordered the Arm & Strom, which took a long time. As that was coming, something about 2020, I just like turned over my entire collection, finally went for it, bought a whole bunch of my independents that I wanted, you know, sold parts of my collection, and then went back and kind of like sometimes you listen to all this esoteric music and sometimes you just want to play the hits. So I got real interested in the Royal Oaks from a design perspective, from a case and bracelet construction perspective. And I was lucky to be able to get a 15500 with a black dial. I'm partial to black dials, so to get that this year. And I think they compare favorably in terms of bracelet. I don't think any bracelet in the world is better than that Royal Oak bracelet. Yeah. It's a disco ball. It's just unbelievable. So
it's not really comparable to anything else.
No, but the watches themselves compare favorably. They, you know, they're both finished very well. They wear very similarly. You know, the 15500 is a little thicker. It's about 10 millimeters, maybe 10.3 millimeters thick, compared to the Jumbo. So, it's a little thinner than the VC, but practically they both wear very similarly. So,
has it still got the 3126 movement in it, or is it different? Did they upgrade it now?
No, it's upgraded. It has the, I don't know if I can remember this number, 40, maybe 4302, something like that. It's actually the movement out of the code 1159. So the nice thing about the 15500, that movement is 32 millimeters wide. So it actually fits that 41 millimeter case much better. I think it looks much better from, you know, from the rear vantage point of that Royal Oak. So,
yeah. And I noticed that the case that connects to the bracelet is a little bit slimmer than the 15400 used to be. So they sort of brought it in kind of like what Rolex did recently, where it's only about a millimeter or so, but you can definitely, I saw two side by side yesterday, a 15.4 versus a 15.5, and you can noticeably see that they've slimmed it down ever so slightly. It does look like a bit of a different aesthetic.
Yeah, it's there. You can tell there's something different about it, and I think removing the automatic text at 6 really opened up the dial and really changed kind of that aperture. Feels a little more expansive because of that. So I quite like it. I like that, and I like the fact that the date wheel lines up exactly along the rehot, and I really like the font of the date wheel as well. So.
They got rid of that tiny little bit of the indice as well on the right hand side of the date.
Yep,
it went
directly.
Which is now just flush.
Much cleaner looking. Yeah. I will say, you know, I got to give AP some props too. You know, we talk about independence being service oriented and stuff, but I had a wonderful experience with them. They, you know, I had very good conversations beforehand. The service was impeccable. They kept me, you know, updated with the situation in terms of when things were going to arrive and shipping. They sent me a bunch of swag, which is kind of cool. I was like, you know, so it, you know, I had a really, really good experience with AP2. So some of the big brands get it and still take care of their customers in the correct way.
Definitely. And I think it's not the brand, it's the people. So if you can find someone in a brand that's just as bonkers or really cares about customer service, you will have a great experience. When you find someone there to just do a job and to pay the bills, it may not turn out as good as what it could have been with someone on the other side of the world.
I
But
agree.
it's about the people.
And I also think people at these brands, especially the ones who, you know, some people who work in the watch industry don't care about watches. But if you happen to be somebody who works in the industry who does care about watches, and you find another collector who is equally passionate and super enthusiastic about getting the piece or knows a lot about it or has been researching it, obviously they're going to want to, you know, they're going to want to make it happen for you because it's very gratifying. It's very gratifying for them to do that. So,
And how's the accuracy been so far? Have you noticed anything, or have you timed it? Or I'm only curious because I know a few people that had some reasonably negative experiences with the previous model, to the point where they sold them because they couldn't handle it anymore. But how's the new movement?
mine's been fantastic. It is right on the money. So it is. I know I'm not an accuracy freak. I mean, there's clocks in every direction I look. So I don't. I if it's off a few, I'm not gonna. I just don't care. Like, but at the same time, like I have noticed that it's on. So.
No, that's awesome. Cool. So I think it was, I did want to talk about a few of the watches.
Yeah, let's talk
The
about anything.
T27, the Titan Hawk, something that I remember when I first saw it, I just thought to myself, bloody hell, that is a exceptional timepiece. So tell us a little bit about that one.
So, I love De Batut. I think they make beautiful watches. I think they are futuristic and classical at the same time. And that specific watch I bought right at the beginning of kind of the pandemic, which is maybe a bad decision because the you know it was 50-50 on if the economy went absolutely in the shitter. But I at least felt gainfully employed as a physician in the middle of a pandemic. So I was like, okay, well, you know, hopefully they'll need me here and I won't have to sell this thing again. But the DB27 is one of De Batut's lowest priced watches, which I don't get, to be honest with you. It's an automatic movement, which is pretty rare for them, with a 6-day power reserve. It has a date function. It has the articulating lugs of the DB28, and then but it has a full dial. So the full dial is more reminiscent of like the DB25, either the Stradivarius or one of the regular DB25s with say a power reserve or just the time. So the fact that it has those articulating lugs and it's an automatic, to me, it's one of the most wearable, useful watches in their entire collection. I love it. It's freaking awesome. I love it. Every time I wear it, I look down and I'm like, I can't believe like humans made this thing. This thing looks like it's from outer space.
It's so true. And I actually, the other day, I was looking up De Bethune, and I've loved them for a number of years. I just think they do some fantastic work. And I remember looking at some stretch goals and going, oh, DB25, that could be really nice. And no word of a lie, about 18 months to 2 years ago, you could get one for somewhere between 20,000 US to 25,000 US, sometimes even less. Even the Titan Hawk, I remember seeing one for low 20s. And I had a look at De Bethune the other day, and not much starts under 40, which
Really?
is, you know, it's a credit to them because, and this is only on Chrono, and you know, Chrono is not the be all and end all, but it's a pretty good indication sometimes. But yeah, they're starting to, obviously they're picking up, and I can see one of your hashtags here, Rise of the Indies, and it's really happening. Like people are really starting to catch on to this stuff for the not individualism, but the rarity and scarcity of the amount of watches that these indies make each year. It's just you're not going to come by another one very often at all, but yeah, they do some seriously cool stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a little bit of a theory about some of these things. So first off, I totally agree with you. I think that the independent watches, they're exploding in popularity. People are taking interest in them, taking notice, and you might want to get in now with some of these brands. I think De Bethune's one of them. I think Groeneveld is experiencing a meteoric rise. The ship's already sailed with FP Journe if you ended up liking those. And, you know, some of the Urwerks are heroically undervalued for what it is. And to your point, when De Bethune makes 120 watches a year, I'll give you, you know, I looked up my watch on their database, and for the 6 year period that it was produced in that dial color, they made 27 total pieces, black dial DB27s. So in 6 years. So when you look at numbers like that, in my opinion, if you're really looking for rarity and potentially things that might be valuable someday, I think there's going to be hundreds of thousands of, you know, Pepsi GMTs new with stickers sitting in the back of a safe, but there just aren't many of these independents. And it's really neat to own something like that. You really feel like you're owning artwork, like you're owning like rare art.
Yeah, it's so true. So I got a question. I think one of the things that I've heard, you know, Tim Mosso always talks about, you know, you can buy this watch from a brand that you know is going to be there in the future to service it. But the reality is we really don't know what's going to happen. And you look at FP Journe as a great example, where 20% of the company was sold to Chanel, and potentially that other companies will do that. That might be part of their business strategy for longevity and things like that. But what's your opinion on, you know, sometimes you can buy these independent watches and think to yourself, shit, you know, if something goes wrong here, what am I going to do with this $20,000-$30,000 watch in 20 years time when it's got a broken part or it needs a service and the company's no longer around? How do you see that in your own mind?
Well, that gives me ulcers, honestly, thinking about that. Like, I just
sorry about that.
because I worry about that. I do worry about that. The one thing I'll say is I know a lot of these brands are really working on that. They want to be, whether it's, you know, Max Booser and MB&F only using, you know, common brass so that his movements are eminently serviceable, to hearing that, I think one of the Groenfelds, maybe it's either their daughter or their niece or something is planning, you know, is in watchmaking school and planning to take over. I know Philippe Dufour is either daughter or is also in watchmaking school. So I do think that these brands are cognizant of this and are trying, and who's to know what technology in the future is going to hold. I mean, there will most likely be the ability to keep your watch going by 3D printing a part to keep it going. So if you just want a serviceable working watch, I don't think that, I think technology will ultimately allow us to keep these things running for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, I think next year, obviously, there's talk in the industry that there's potential that some brands will sort of start to drop off, unfortunately, due to the pandemic, etc. And I mean, we've really only seen Romain Jerome this year, but I haven't really seen any, over the last, say, 5 years, there's not been any huge crashes of you know, massive, not massive independents, because none of them are really massive, but really well loved that are sort of disappearing. And it was an interesting move by FP Journe to go do that, but it sort of solidifies that capital investment for the next however many years that Chanel's going to be around for, which is probably way longer than
it's a smart business decision to align yourself with some type of revenue stream. I know Armin Strom, one of the founders of there, has some means that way. So So that portends some, you know, some safety for them, you know. But I think the popularity, fortunately, is going to let a lot of these independents weather the storm. Try to buy a Groeneveld right now. Try to order one. You're looking at a 12 to 18 month wait for anything. You know, they produce under 100 watches a year, so that's There's not, with 7 billion people on the planet, you don't need too many orders to be gainfully employed. So.
Yeah. And Habering is a great example. So there's some really good interviews. I can't remember who did it, so apologies to them. But there was an interview that on YouTube that you can watch. If you search Richard Habering, you'll find it very quickly. And he talks about sustainability in the watch industry for him and for his partners around him that he sources for movement parts, etc., and balances and all that kind of stuff. And I think, you look at Habering as an example where they make roughly 120 watches a year, give or take, and they rarely make more than 10 types of each watch per year. So you're never going to see hundreds and hundreds of these watches for a long time. And then you look on Chrono 24, and at the moment, and I watch Habering a lot, at the moment there's 6 for sale across the whole world. So all the others have gone to owners that have kept them and will probably continue to buy one, maybe two, maybe three Haberings over the next couple of years because they love the brand. So in a lot of ways, Richard Habering, for example, they're really not making watches that already don't have a buyer, if that makes sense, because they're just not, they don't have traction on the secondary market because people don't sell them, and they rarely come up. So I think he's got a really good grasp on what's going to happen in the bad times and how can we come back from that? How can we continue to support our partners around us who are small family businesses just like us? And we hope that can continue, but it does sound like a sustainable business model moving forward to control that amount of watches that you make, and they're really only going to people that are going to buy them and keep them.
I do think the secondary market, I think there's one thing that people forget, and that's if you go to sell one of these independents, it's a very small world. Like pretty much everybody kind of knows everybody else. So it's actually a fairly sensitive sort of endeavor to pursue if you're gonna sell one. So I actually think that even though there aren't a lot that are traded via Chrono 24, that most of the sales are happening person to person in a private, discreet way, from collector to collector. I think that that is probably what's happening, because I know plenty of people who, who still would s sell an independent watch, and but publicizing that is not necessarily the best sort of thing
No.
to do. So it's a little different than, selling a sub or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, and it's something I hadn't thought about. That yeah, most likely, I mean, I've done that myself when I've had some things for sale. I'm not going to put it on eBay. I just go out to the crew that I think would be interested in it. Chances are someone's going to want it for whatever reason because they've got the watch or they've wanted one of those. So yeah, that's a really good point that there's probably a lot of hidden trading that goes on, which is good because I think that's the way to do it, especially when people have been looking at a watch that you've had for many years, and for whatever reason, maybe you've moved on or you want to sell it to buy something else, and they get first opportunity to buy it because you know how much they love it. Then fantastic, you're supporting the hobby, and so be it. Go
Some
forth.
of the and some of the things are, long since discontinued. It's the only way to buy it if you want a particular watch. So that's I, you know, I I'm a proponent of that. I will say though, if you have the opportunity to buy one new, if it's still regular production and you can do it, from a financial standpoint and from a time standpoint, being a part of that process and supporting the makers directly feels very good. It feels like a very good thing to do. Sometimes it's not possible, but I like I said, I bought my David Thune pre-owned, and if I ever sold it, I can tell you I would sell it. One, I would sell it for another David Thune because I love the brand too much, and two, I want my babies to go to good homes, so I would sell it to somebody who was going to enjoy it and love it as much as I have.
Good stuff. Good stuff. I got two more questions.
Sure.
And the first one is you kind of touched on it before. Have you ever sold something that you later regretted selling?
Oh man. No. I'm going to say no because I really enjoy the ride. I really enjoy the journey. There's one watch that I've just not seen again, and it was kind of a terrible watch, but it was a Omega Speedmaster Reduced with I think it was JDM. It had a white dial, and I bought it for very cheap. This is when I very first started collecting, and I sold it for basically what I paid for it. And I kind of wish I had that watch back, because just white dial, especially kind of, kind of near vintage white dial Speedmasters are pretty damn rare. I don't see them very often. So I guess if I have to answer that, but I enjoy, any watches I sell, I just move on. There's always going to be more. And I really have kind of two, it's the reason I answered the original quick fire question with, I had a hard time with keep or sell, keep or flip, is because there's a portion of my collection which are absolute keepers, permanent collection things, and there's a portion of my collection which, if I see other watches that I become interested in, or if my tastes change, I would be willing to move those on to a good home to experience something new. In the end, I'm just trying to experience as many watches as I can. And there's nothing like owning it. Watching a Tim Mosso video is very, very good. And seeing your friends is good. And of course, Instagram is wonderful for living vicariously through others, but not there's nothing like holding it in your hand. So.
Yeah, definitely. The only things I've done is I've nearly sold watches that I would have regretted now, and I'm so glad that people, wonderful enablers in the watch industry, and my darling wife said, "Do not sell that." And I'm
Do
so
not
glad that
sell
I
that.
haven't, because I would have extremely regretted selling the tag that my father bought me, and my BLNR, because I fell out of love for a period of time and wanted the Moser. And yeah, I'm so pleased that I didn't do that, because I would not be happy with myself right now.
Yeah, my PSA to any listeners is don't sell sentimental watches ever. Never. It's just you're never going to be able to get it back if and if you do, you got lucky, and so just don't do it in the first place.
It's so true, but the battle, the internal battle inside your head when you've got, it might be $10,000 sitting in a watch that you rarely wear, or you've fallen out of in love with, and there's this new shiny thing that's come out that's amazing and you just want it. Don't do it, because you will regret it, and the watch that you get is not going to be as good as the one you had that was sentimental. So
That's right.
I got out of that one alive, I think, which is great.
I bought a few back for a second time,
You
I can say
have?
that much. Not too often. Usually once I've experienced it and I move it on, I'm like, I'm done. That's good. But I have bought a couple back. But the weird thing is the ones I buy back, I've sold again. So
So you should have just learned
it's like
the first
I should have
time.
just learned the
Oh
first time.
well, it's part of the journey.
That's right.
All right, last question before we move to the Instagram recommendations is, what is the last watch that you've added into your Chrono 24 notepad? So this is the first time I'm asking this question, but it's probably going to be something that I'll ask people in the future. So, and I'm also going to share mine. So, have you had enough time to scramble and get your Chrono 24 notepad out yet?
I don't know what a Chrono 24 notepad is, so that
Oh
might
man.
derail your question, but if you're talking about the next watch I want to buy,
Yeah, go on.
is that what it is?
It's so the Chrono 24 notepad is where you save a watch. So you're looking on Chrono 24 and you save it, and it goes into like a saved, almost like a saved folder, that which is called the notepad. And they just sort of sit in there, and you can just get all googly-eyed looking at them, or potentially go down a rabbit hole to want to buy them. But I've got, I don't know,
Oh well, shit! I
probably.
have I didn't know
Oh,
that
good.
I didn't know that function existed, but I have that in my mind where I just keep typing it like an old person, keep typing it into the search box because I memorized the reference number.
All right, go on. So what's something, or what's the latest thing in your head right now?
A Longinsona,
Ooh.
38.5 millimeter Longa One, rose gold, black dial. 101.031. So that's the one. It's a I like the new ones as well, but I like the case proportions of the previous ones. And
yeah.
The only other watch that I just lust after that I know I'll probably never, there's just not many of them, is a MB&F LM1 collaboration with Alain Silberstein.
Yeah.
So I like that watch a lot too.
But that's the MB&F I'd like is the HM5, the Horological Machine 5, which is that driver watch based off the, I can't remember what it's called, but that 70s watch.
The Argengraph thing?
He did a collaboration with Saponeva as well in the HM5. I don't know. So it's where you look at the watch side on and you can see the scrolling hours and minutes. But yeah, HM5 is what I'd like one day, but don't know if I'll ever get it. But the watch that I recently added to my notepad in Chrono was the Roger Dubuis Much More White Gold. So this is, if you've got to kind of think of
Frank Mueller-esque a little bit.
Yes, very much like that. But also it has the lugs of a Peter Speke Marin. So it's got those sort of bolts that stick out, but it's got the square or rectangular case, but with the elongated numbers. But this thing is $5,900 Australian dollars. It is white gold. It has a Geneva seal movement. Only thing is it does have a round movement in the square case, and that kind of looks a bit strange. But Geneva seal movement, 28-piece limited edition. And so US dollars, you're talking high threes, low fours, original box, no papers, in good condition. Like, that is a insane watch, and it's 21 mil by 38 mil, so it's going to be a really nice, elegant sort of size. But yeah, awesome value for money. And again, these early Roger Dubuis are already starting to go up, and before people realize it, this is the time to get into them, because the sympathies are long gone, the homage chronographs are long gone. Things like this at 5K in white gold with the Geneva seal movement, steel blue hands, just stunning. Absolutely stunning for that price.
Yeah, Roger Dubuis, the early ones are fantastic. I think that's a great choice. I've toyed with the idea of buying a Much More before. So I empathize with you. So
I'd also like a Frank Mueller Crazy Hours, because I think that's just insane. That is, to me, that complication is today's world where everything is just upside down and spun around and back to front. And it really does speak to me, that watch, because it's just such a cool piece.
We are certainly living in crazy times, and that would fit the bill. So absolutely. Either got to go with the flow, or you can swim against the grain and get something like your Moser, which is just the epitome of organization and symmetry.
Yep, exactly. All right. Well, I think we can start to wrap up now. Hour and a half in, I've really, really enjoyed this conversation, Dustin. So thank you so much.
Me too. I can't believe I'm doing it. I listen to you guys all the time. I'd go on drives with my kids, and I put it on, and they're. My 3-year-old.
Hopefully not finally... the explicit versions.
No, it's okay. Dear. They're you know, you got to hear it somewhere first. But he's like, what are we listening to? I'm like, we're listening to watches. And he's like, why do you always listen to watches? It's funny. I was like, because I'm sick in the head.
Oh dear, that's awesome. Well, I'm. It's really, really pleasing to hear that Fifth Risk can be the place where young kids can come and listen to swear words and things for the first time. And
that's absolutely right. But no, thank you very much for having me. It's been a wonderful wonderful time talking to you, and I you know, happy to come talk to you guys anytime you all have me. That's great.
That's great. And there's also, so you did a podcast as well earlier in the year, I think, with Whiskey and Watches podcast, so for people interested, you can go and check out that as well on your favorite podcatcher. But that was a great episode too. There's a lot of cool watch talk in that one, which was great.
Yeah, those are some local guys, really. They're really local to me, and they're doing a good job. And
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of get on there and talk with them as well. So it's always fun talking watches. I can pretty much do it 24/7.
Man, we're the same here, so don't expect this to be the first and last time you come on the podcast, because I think there's some opinions we potentially haven't quite explored in here that I'd like to do next time. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Sure.
But let's go Instagram recommendations. So I'll go first. So today mine is beer style. So BERR and style. It's all one word. I believe gentleman's name is Winston Kwang. Craft beer distributor based in Singapore, sharing the love for American craft beers and also a watch enthusiast. Now, he has a crazy collection, much like yours, to be honest, because there's some Grunfeld there, there's some Ervac, there's some Gerald Genter, there is the Mont Blanc Minerva movements, there's some Oris, there's just this guy has everything, and he can certainly take a photo. Very, very nice photography. He's even got an Armin Strom as well. So it's quite a great collection of watches, but also a great photographer as well. And anyone that likes produces craft beer, for me, that they're in my good book. So good on him. So beer style, Winston Kwang.
Beer style.
Check him out.
All right.
Cool. And yours?
All right. So I'm gonna recommend one of my really good friends who
Can't be Asher,
horologically
right?
inclined. I think he might have actually been a fifth wrist
He
guest
has.
at some point, horologically inclined.
Yeah, he's a legend. So, yeah, cool. Absolutely. I think he needs more followers.
The one thing I like about some of the stuff he posts is that his collection is bonkers, of course.
Yeah.
He has a lot of new stuff, so there's always a lot of new eye candy. But aside from that, I think he posts some thought-provoking questions and really gets people talking. Instagram has been one of the best things for the watch community because, in my eyes, not so much for the pictures, but just for the interaction, private messages and things like that.
Yeah.
I switched my handle was just my last name, and I switched it to something a little more anonymous, because well, for some anonymity, but and I was a little worried that people weren't going to find me, but the watch fam always finds you. So I actually came up with my Instagram name because normal
I was going to say, what does it mean? Sorry. Can you
so
tell us what it
normal
means?
it's normal.sinus.rhythm. And like I said, I'm a cardiac anesthesiologist, and normal sinus rhythm is the normal rhythm of your heart, which is paced by your sinoatrial node or your SA node. So it is the timekeeper of your heart. So
Very good.
for
Makes
me,
sense.
it's a double entendre. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
So although spelling rhythm is painful, so maybe it wasn't super well thought out, but
I had to look it up today.
yeah.
Yeah, rhythm is a word that always gets me. I always remember R and then I think it's Y, but that H just gets me every time because
I
it's got
know.
two of them.
The English language is tricky.
Anyway. It is. But no, Asher is a great friend of the show, and he's also a knife enthusiast as well, which is fantastic because him and I have been chatting back and forth, and I got to send him a video of my new piece the other day, and yeah, so check him out. Horologically Inclined, absolutely awesome collection, and part of the collective as well, which is great.
Yeah, he's trying to get me into knives too, and I have a few, but nothing. I'm not into like the custom stuff yet.
Yeah.
I'm really reluctant to add another deficiency, I'm
Yeah.
gonna call it, because I just don't know if I
Addiction.
can. I don't know if yeah, I don't know if I can tolerate it.
Nah, I tell you, I really hope my strategy around get the best you can afford and don't worry about going so much through the journey. I mean, I've been collecting knives since I was a kid, but I've done nothing like I've done recently with this custom piece, and I hope that this doesn't just entrap me down a huge rabbit hole, 'cause yeah, I'd rather spend money on other things, but anyway, we'll see what happens.
I think what you say about buying the best you can afford, with watches or with any other collectibles, but especially watches, you can really fall into a situation where you're comparing yourself to others, and I would just advise people not to do that. I've definitely fallen victim to that, where I look at somebody else's collection or watches, and I'm like, man, if only I had that. But if you take a step back, look at your own stuff. And just be proud of what you have, be happy with what you have, and buy things within your means. It's not worth comparing yourself to other people. One nice thing is most of the good watch people I know are really respectful and get just as excited over a Swatch as they do over a MB&F. So.
It's so true. And I think that, the only thing that I'll say about myself doing what I've done recently is with sort of getting this custom piece made and just getting a, spending the money now and not going through is I do think to myself, what on that journey am I going to be missing? But I'm kind of thinking I've been collecting Swiss Army knives and things for so many years that I've sort of had the journey, but I've not had the tiered journey up to a custom piece. But to be honest, and this is something I've not shared before, since so recently I've been my wife gave me a beautiful Montblanc fountain pen for our wedding, which was back in 2016. And I hadn't really used it much. And recently I thought, no, I'm going to get it out and start using it. Unfortunately, I need to get the nib tuned and all sorts of stuff. It's just not writing like it was. But I've started to get a bit more intrigued in fountain pens and this knife as well. And it's actually really made me stop and look at my watch collection and be extremely content that right now, at this very moment, I have no plans on buying another watch for a decent amount of time because I'm super, super happy with what I've got. I don't know what I can afford that would sort of outweigh what I've currently got now, and what would I not want to put on right now that would make me go buy another watch. And yes, I've recently got the Moser, but I feel like I'm getting over that honeymoon period now. So it's interesting that another collecting sort of fountain pens or knives has made me look back at my collection and just be really content and really happy with what I've got. So if you anyone out there needs to stop buying watches, go look at something else and it will take your mind off it, and you can just be happy with what you've got. I don't know if it's going to work, but we'll see.
Yeah, no,
Oh dear.
it's a really good place to find yourself in, where you're content and happy with what you have. So.
All right. Well, Dustin, thank you so much again for coming on. I'd really love to get you back on to continue the conversation because to me, I think talking to you was just really great watch talk, which is what I love, and sharing the story with your father and with the OPs as a tribute to your mum, I just think it's the most beautiful thing, and I congratulate you and your father on doing something like that together because it's wonderful. So thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you, Anthony. And anybody who's listening, look me up on Instagram. I'm happy to talk watches anytime I'm not taking care of patients or with my family. But I do have a very tolerant wife, I can tell you that much, with all the watch banter that goes around, so.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, cool. So for everyone else listening out there, if you want to join our Slack group, we are absolutely having the time of our lives. By the time this goes out, it would have been old news, but last night the gents got together in Melbourne and had another Rob Fest where they played mini golf and they went out for dinner, and it was, I was so jealous I couldn't be there. But yeah, if you want to come into our Slack group, it's so much fun. So just reach out to me, anthony@fifthwrist.com, and we'll get you in there. And you can, we've got people now from absolutely all ends of the earth. And it's just all about watches and having fun and projects and the podcast and the website and reviewing your own watches at fifthwrist.com. So check that out when you can as well. All right, Dustin, thank you so much. Have a fantastic rest of the evening and wish you and your family a great holiday season. By the time this comes out, it'll be Happy New Year. So Happy New Year, everyone. But yeah, thanks a lot again, Dustin. Have a great time.
Thank you too, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right, and for everyone else, stay on time.